of one of the sons. He was a 22-year-old with no history of violence, but his story is just part of the journey that Booth took as she researched and wrote her book. The bigger story is about the complexity of mental health issues and diagnoses. It's the story of our recognizing mental illness, understanding it, and finding help for those in need. Her new book is called Out of Nowhere, Inside the Mind of a Mass Murderer, and Janice Holly Booth joins us again for the hour. Welcome back.
Thanks, Mike. I'm glad to be here.
Nice to have you here. And given the medical nature of much of what we'll be talking about today, we've also invited Dr. Stephen Strzelecki to be with us. He is the lead psychologist for the Forensic Evaluations Unit in the Criminal Justice Services Department for Mecklenburg County. He formerly served as supervising psychologist with the Mecklenburg County Area Mental Health Authority. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Mike. Glad to be here.
Good to see you. Now, you went from this light, frothy book about, putting a backpack on your back with only the bare necessities and doing whatever the heck you wanted to on a whim, to this travel into the deep, dark recesses of one individual's mind. Why? What made you want to do that?
Well, Mike, A Voice Out of Nowhere is actually the book I've always wanted to write. Ever since I was involved in this case as a court recorder, I became completely and utterly fascinated with the mental disease known as schizophrenia. And by following the trial, I should back up and say that one of the reasons that I was so obsessed with schizophrenia was that I had, at 23 years old, I had already lost two good friends to its consequences. One had committed suicide while under suicide watch in a mental hospital, and the other had been murdered by his roommate, who was also schizophrenic and had gone off his meds. And so I felt, I was so angry that the system had not kept them safe the way that it was supposed to, and I decided that I would study it. I would study the disease. I would learn as much as I could, but what I really wanted to do was get inside the mind of someone with that disease.
Well, you talk about being a court reporter at one point in your life in Canada. This all took place in Canada back in 1980 when a woman you recognized from one of your writing classes was brought into court because she had attempted suicide and had been classified as a paranoid schizophrenic with delusions of grandeur. Officer of the court said she thinks she's a writer, and you knew, in fact, that she was a writer. And a year later, I think you refer to this, another one of your friends became a paranoid schizophrenic who was murdered by his roommate. You saw this as a failure of the system. So you started interviewing, researching, etc. How did you begin that process?
Well, of course, being in the court system, I had access to the backstory, her backstory, my friend's backstory, and my other friend who was murdered. And I got to see the quote, care that they received, and it was subpar at best. Again, I think both of these deaths could have been prevented if my friends had received the correct treatment and support. And so, but I also, because I was close to them and had worked with them and saw what really good writers they were, I wanted to understand what happened to their brain, what changed. And so I talked to every doctor I could gain access to. I read everything I could. I took classes, and that's how it began.
You know, as I was reading your story about the backstory for the book, it struck me that there are a lot of writers who have mental problems. Sometimes they drown them in alcohol. Sometimes they drown them in drugs. Other times they turn out to be seriously mentally ill. Not all writers, of course, but there are a number of instances. What do you think it is about? Is there something about writing and the brain that makes you a little off?
makes me a little off? Well, I don't think we can blame that on my writing, Mike. I don't know. I know that artists in general tend to have a different kind of view of the world, and that informs their art, and that's what makes their art so interesting.
So this took place, your initial exposure to this took place in 1980. It's been 35 years. What took you so long to write this book? This is the book you've always wanted to write. What took so long?
That's a great question. I actually started writing the book in 1985, which was 2 years after the murders. And then I moved to the United States, and life kind of took over. And you've read the book. You know it's very difficult subject matter. I kept coming back to the story and trying to write it, and it just never felt right. It was too uncomfortable, and it never felt like the right time. Mm. But then when we started having these mass murders committed by young men with mental problems, the voice in my head said, I think you should start reconsidering.
You wanted this to coincide with the trial of James Holmes,
yes,
who committed the murders in the Aurora, Colorado movie theater. And today,
yes,
his trial begins. You said, and we'll come back to that in a second, but you said that you witnessed among your friends, your acquaintances who had this problem, kind of a low level of care or abysmal care. I'm not sure exactly what words you've used, but you talk about in the book failures in the system. And this took place in Canada, and it took place 35 years ago. Have things changed in Canada? Are there failures in the system here that are comparable today in the United States, in North Carolina, to what you saw in Canada?
Well, back then in the 80s, if you knew where to go, you could get help if you had mental issues. But Canada actually followed the United States lead with closing the mental hospitals. The United States began, I think, in the 50s and 60s. Canada began in the 80s. And in closing the mental hospitals, more and more mentally ill people were put out on the street and were not given the support that they were supposed to get. And I know the doctor can comment on this. The idea behind closing the mental hospitals was, we're not going to warehouse these people anymore. We're going to let them out. We're going to give them care in the community so that they can live meaningful lives. That never materialized.
Best laid plans. This happened in the United States. It happened, I believe, during the Reagan administration, when a lot of people were released from mental institutions and put into the community. And in many cases, left to fend for themselves. I believe that is why we saw the rise in homelessness around the country, and particularly in the nation's capital when I was living there. Doctor, you want to talk about that? Dr. Strzelecki, I'm going to get your name right before this show is over, if he kills me.
No problem, Mike. I think, as Ms. Booth mentioned, this actually started back in the 50s with the development of the antipsychotic medications.
Okay.
And what those were supposed to do was to allow individuals with serious mental illness, such as schizophrenia, be released from the hospitals and live in the community. What we know now, more than then, I believe, is that the medications are certainly helpful, and they do a significantly wonderful job of addressing the positive symptoms, the hallucinations, the delusions, but they're not a cure-all. There are still negative symptoms,
like
lack of emotions, social struggles, difficulties initiating activities. So just giving a medication isn't the total answer.
And because they make the patient feel like they're walking in a haze in many cases, or have no ambition, or they just can't connect to the world because they've been the drugs are suppressing their emotions. They sometimes don't like to take the drugs, and in fact don't take the drugs, right?
And that's probably the most common problem with all medications is compliance. Mm-hmm. Certainly with the psychotropics, these kinds of medications, it is true that they can have the sedating effects, make them feel different, they can't think clearly and things like that, so that once they do not experience the hallucinations, the delusional thinking, they feel better, they stop the medications. And then that starts the cycle of on and off medications, crises in and out of the hospital or other facilities, which is certainly part of the struggle that the community faces with individuals with these serious mental
illness. But do we also fail to recognize what we're looking at in many cases? And we're going to talk about Bruce Blackman, who's the subject of this book, and the young man who committed all the murders at Sandy Hook Elementary, because in both of these cases, and maybe in James Holmes' case, I don't know, in both of these cases, the Sandy Hook and the case in your book, we're talking about young men whose parents knew there was something wrong and thought they could handle it themselves. Is that part of the failure of the system?
And it's part of the stigma that's still associated with mental illness in this country and in Canada and throughout the world, that there is the sense of that the family's going to handle it themselves. They want to deal with this. They want to keep this private. They may not be comfortable reaching out to mental health professionals as they would if it was cancer, going out to see an oncologist. And so as a result, they're trying to do things on their own and meet their child's needs when they really need the professionals. They need a team involved to help them with someone with this level of difficulty.
I can't think of the young man in Sandy Hook's first name, the perpetrator. His last name is Lanza.
Adam Lanza.
Adam Lanza. Was he a schizophrenic?
I believe so. I don't know his official diagnosis, but I believe so.
Bruce Blackman, the subject of your book, was a paranoid schizophrenic. Does a paranoid schizophrenic always have violent, super violent, murderous tendencies?
Well, the obvious answer is they don't always have those tendencies, but they individuals with schizophrenia, paranoid schizophrenia, who are acutely psychotic and experiencing multiple symptoms. So, for example, if they have the delusional thinking and hallucinations, and the hallucinations can be command hallucinations, telling them to do things that at some point they recognize is not reality, but other times they do not. And it's difficult for them to separate what is fact from fiction and how to respond on their own versus follow what the command hallucinations tell them to do.
This usually happens in young men, in their teenage years? Late teenage years, that's when it begins to present itself?
Absolutely, late adolescence, early adulthood.
Do the symptoms build over time, or do they spring on these individuals full-blown? Do you become a paranoid schizophrenic with delusions of grandeur like that, or does it build over time?
Sure. It's usually not overnight. And in the case of Bruce Blackman, I think if you look back, there was certainly a downward spiral that he was experiencing. The acute symptoms came on about a month or so before the murders, but certainly there were symptoms well before that in terms of changing in his habits and his social activities and his hygiene and all those sorts of things that people could have seen and recognized.
Is it difficult to diagnose for a medical professional?
For mental health professionals, someone like Bruce Blackman, if they were to come in, I do not think that would be difficult. Symptoms are pretty significant.
Is it difficult for a layperson, a family member, to recognize that this is more than just a phase, or this is more than just something that he's misinterpreting things and we can fix that? Or do you realize fairly soon that this is something serious?
I think it can be families not wanting to recognize some of the symptoms, and others that may initially look like young adults changing habits, trying to find themselves, things like that. But certainly as the symptoms progress, it becomes very clear that it's not part of the normal adolescent process.
Yeah, some of the you write about the fact that he lived for a while with a roommate, and the roommate began to notice some of these signs. But, you know, when you described the conditions in which they lived, it was like a college bachelor pad. And college guys don't clean up after themselves very often. The place is a mess. They eat cold pizza on a regular basis, which he was doing. Sometimes they don't bathe. I mean, that's just how it is. So when you look at what's going on, you may think, well, just a bunch of guys. They'll get their act together when they grow up. They haven't grown up yet. Is that what happened in Bruce Blackman's case, in part of it at least?
I think in part of it, yes, because Bruce and his roommate were both heavy users of marijuana, which is another problem.
That's right.
But interestingly, the psychiatrist came to the house, signed commitment papers.
Let me stop you because we have to go to a break, and we'll pick up the story where we left it off. Janice Holly Booth's book is called A Voice Out of Nowhere, Inside the Mind of a Mass Murderer. She's here with Dr. Steven Strzelecki with the Criminal Justice Services Department in Mecklenburg County. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Black Hawk Hardware, presenting the Big Green Egg event Saturday, May 16th. Samples and demonstrations by the Big Green Egg demo team, locally owned and mismanaged since 1977. BlackHawkHardware.com. Well, a lot of political satirists work in comedy clubs and on television, but none have been working longer than Mark Russell. He started in the 50s around Washington, D.C. He became a local phenomenon first, and then thanks to PBS, after 30 years of specials there, he became a national phenomenon, even appearing very regularly on, of all programs, Meet the Press. He retired in 2010, but not for long. 2 years later, he went back out to the, took himself out of mothballs, but back out on the road with the fresh zingers aimed at our political hotspots. He's on his way to this area, and we spend an hour with Mark Russell tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the accidental deaths of two Western hostages raises concerns about the limits of U.S. intelligence and the consequences of drone warfare. What the incident means for the future of U.S. counterterrorism operations.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're with Janice Holly Booth, a Charlottean. Well, she's been here for a while, but she's actually a Canadian. Charlottean and author of A Voice Out of Nowhere, Inside the Mind of a Mass Murderer. Dr. Stephen Strzelecki is also with us, administrator and lead psychologist in the Forensic Evaluations Unit with Criminal Justice Services in Mecklenburg County. And we're talking about mass murderers. Today is the day that James Holmes goes on trial. We'll talk about that in a second. He's the Aurora, Colorado movie theater murderer. I was talking about how easy or difficult this is to spot by lay people, and the fact that Bruce Blackman, the subject of your book, could have looked to somebody casually observing as an ordinary young college dropout guy living with the roommates, doing too much pot, not bathing, kind of watching a lot of TV. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of that goes on a lot, and they're not mentally ill. They're just that's what they do.
Right, right. Well, Bruce did give a clue to his roommate. He said, "What would you think if I told you I was God?" And his roommate laughed and said, "Yeah, pot smoking God, I could dig that." And Bruce very seriously said, "No, I'm God. I'm just not sure if I'm supposed to die or the people around me." Now, Bruce's roommate never told anyone that until court. But the family became so concerned about Bruce that they called a psychiatrist to come to the house. Remember, this was back in the early 80s. That still happened. The psychiatrist came, examined him, and signed commitment papers. But instead of committing Bruce, which I believe would have averted the tragedy, he handed the commitment papers to the father and said, "Here, use this if you need to." 31 days after that commitment paper was signed, Bruce committed the mass murder.
Which is, he killed his family.
Yes.
We'll talk about most members of his family, except for his twin brother, Todd. You originally wrote and released this book to coincide with the James Holmes trial, which begins today. He committed the murders in the theater in Aurora, Colorado, several years ago. And you say that you wanted your book to be available as a resource for anyone curious about what might have been going on in Holmes' head when he perpetrated his attack. Are there similarities to his case and the case you write about in your book?
Well, of course, we won't know until we hear the evidence. But just based on the information that that I noticed when, after the tragedy, you know, the orange hair, the lack of affect when they arrested him, I believe that he thought he was part of the movie, that he was a character in the movie. And so in that way, I would say yes. I mean, he had delusions, he had false beliefs, and so we'll see. But yes, I do believe that there are going to be similarities.
So what is happening, Doctor, in the mind of somebody who becomes a paranoid schizophrenic with delusions of grandeur? Is it something? Is it the way the brain is constructed? Is it some sort of electrical misfire? Is it a chemical thing that's gone wrong in the brain? Do we know what happens?
Well, the answer is yes, but we don't know exactly what happens. And certainly, it is. There's a genetic component. We know that in terms of studies with families and the incidents with first degree relatives and with siblings and with twins, that there's a greater incidence of mental illness and schizophrenia in the families. But there's also, it's a more of a predisposition to developing schizophrenia, so it's not a guarantee.
Are there ways to spot that early on in life?
Well, that certainly is what a lot of research is doing, is trying to go back and look at individuals, where they were when they were younger, maybe earlier adolescence, childhood, look at symptoms or behaviors or things. And I certainly, with In Bruce Blackman's case, while he was well-loved by the family and had a lot of positive traits, he also was struggling in school early on. And again, that's not saying that anyone who was struggling in school has a major mental illness, but there were potentially sort of soft signs or symptoms that may have been picked up if he maybe got some counseling earlier on and throughout high school. Not maybe prevented this, but at least had an earlier handle on what he was experiencing.
You write about this in the book. He had an identical twin, Todd. But their physical identity was where it stopped, because Todd was extremely organized. He did very well in school, and you say that by eighth grade it was clear that Bruce was erratic and impulsive. He was struggling in school. were those warning signs of trouble ahead, or is this just one teenager or one young teenager rebelling against the perfection of his twin?
I think both, and I think that Bruce's heavy use of marijuana—
In the eighth grade?
But yes, he began in the seventh grade, I believe, and by the eighth grade, he was a daily user. I think that that contributed to whatever vulnerability he had in his brain.
And his mother took him to a psychologist in the eighth grade who talked to him and gave him a test that wasn't a test and described him as he and his brother as being mirror twins. Is that an actual diagnosis, an actual condition, being a mirror twin?
Well, I'm going to let the doctor speak, but, you know, it's sort of a joke now, but I guess back then it was considered legitimate.
Because it meant that he was the opposite.
And that was the seed that was planted.
Yes, I was going to ask you if that's true, because he interpreted that as being, well, he's not dumber than his brother. He's just the opposite. So if his brother's going to be this excellent person, he's not going to be that. Is that a real diagnosis,
well,
doctor?
Tom, I'll tell you, that was given before I became a psychologist, but it is not something I've ever heard of. And when I read that in the book as well, I was thinking what misinformation this family got at an early age that this young man internalized and took on as part of his personality. And it really gave him an excuse to fail, to not care, to be heavily involved in drugs, all those kinds of things, when at that point it might have been he needed some counseling, could have got some tutoring, could have got some support.
But even if he had gotten that tutoring, yes, that counseling, that support, would it have been inevitable that he would have become schizophrenic? Is it inevitable? Is it foretold? Because that's just the makeup of your brain.
It's very hard to say, but certainly in this young man's case, in Bruce's case, there were a number of factors. Certainly the heavy drug use, and that can alter the brain's functioning. And so if he had a predisposition to it, so for example, if you're predisposed to high cholesterol, if you're eating lots of red meat and fatty foods, it's going to be a problem. Even if you have a vegetarian diet, you may still have high cholesterol, but it may not be at the same level as if you're eating an unhealthy diet. So in this case, what happened at this point in his life that changed how he approached things may have exacerbated or sort of sped up the process of experiencing the difficulties he did. I'm not sure, but so certainly he had a risk for it.
But if you're an identical twin, shouldn't your brain structure, chemistry, biology, whatever you want to call it, be somewhat similar? If you're looking at somebody across the room who looks precisely like you because you were born precisely at the same time from the same egg, why would he turn out to be schizophrenic and his brother not?
And again, it's
why would he be a low achiever and his brother
not? It's not a one-to-one comparison, but there are other factors that we may not know about. So, for example, prenatal or perinatal trauma. So during the pregnancy or childbirth, Bruce may have suffered mild trauma that later on had an effect on his brain development. Oftentimes, we talk about schizophrenia evolving in adolescence, young adulthood, that's when the brain is also changing.
Right.
So the structural change that may have happened early on from an injury or from an infection doesn't manifest until later on when the brain is changing, developing into an adult brain.
So when this began to manifest itself, he did believe that he was God. He believed that doomsday was coming, that Armageddon was coming. He didn't know whether he was supposed to die or the people around him were supposed to die, but he knew, and he would see signs in the heavens. He would see stars, and he told his father that there was something in the Bible that he needed to understand. And his father said, sensibly, there's a lot of things in there that we need to understand, but I'm not sure that, you know, but he thought there was something communicating directly to him from the pages of that book. And he is not alone in that. A lot of paranoid schizophrenics have that feeling. Why? What is it about religion?
Well, I think certainly there's an organizing sense to religion in terms of right and wrong and following the Bible and the rules that are laid down that for someone who is experiencing a major mental illness like schizophrenia, they interpret personally, and it might give them a sense of direction. There certainly is a sense of grandiosity. So when you talk about religion and God, and certainly in this case with this young man, he wasn't sure whether he was God or whether he was Satan. Mm-hmm. Could be both. There's certainly a common theme in individuals with that sort of experience.
He also began to act out. He did some relatively disgusting things that we don't need to get into in great detail on this program, like mixing up a cocktail of disgusting ingredients for his sister to drink. And he thought that he needed to eat portions of his body as a sacrament.
Excretions,
now,
yes.
I mean, to me, all right, but to me, that's if you are a parent or a brother or a sister of somebody in that situation doing those things and you know about it, something is seriously wrong.
Yes, yes. And early on, you know, when Bruce was first beginning to hear these voices and hear these commands and felt so compelled to learn whatever that message was in the Bible, he alternately would say, "Help me. I'm possessed. Help me."
Mm-hmm.
How much more clear do you have to be? And help was not forthcoming.
Do most people who suffer from this condition, who hear voices and commands, and somebody says that the voices and commands that these people hear are just like me talking to you, that it's completely real. They actually hear this. They want those voices to stop in most cases, don't they?
Absolutely, absolutely. And certainly the medication that Bruce was initially prescribed, and these days most individuals with schizophrenia prescribed, will have a dramatic, significant positive impact on that, reduce or eliminate those experiences. But as we talked about, compliance with medication is an issue. And in this case, with this young man, it really was an acute situation. He needed to be in a psychiatric facility where he could be monitored 24 hours a day, ensure he's taking his medications, receive the structural support that he would need in order to meet his needs at that time.
So his parents, his family, pretty much ignored all of the warning signs, even the grotesque warning signs. They just ignored them for whatever reason. And so did Mrs. Lanza at Sandy Hook. So I was going to ask you if that would happen in the United States today, if it could happen, if it could happen here. Clearly it could.
It could.
But how?
How? That someone is kept out of the public enough that they do not have access to mental health care or follow up with mental health care, that they family is not as involved. So, for example, in this case where when Bruce would meet with the psychiatrist, he may be telling the psychiatrist part of the story, but you really need to have collateral sources of information. So the family, while they were involved, they really needed to give the psychiatrist and all the treating professionals the full story, give them the full picture, because certainly we know that he had a mental illness, and that was clear. And he was dangerous to himself or others. That was the other thing. In terms of his behaviors, certainly his lack of self-care and hygiene would be enough to meet the criteria to have him hospitalized. Mm-hmm. But then the other things that he was doing with the cocktail for his sister and other kinds of things were also dangerous to others.
Right.
So there were clear signs and symptoms that would meet the criteria to receive inpatient psychiatric care for stabilization and then go forward from there.
Why did his family ignore the signs?
They ignored them initially until Bruce got to the point where they felt they had to call the psychiatrist to the house. But the psychiatrist was not forthcoming with them. He didn't say, "Your son has a serious mental illness and he could become dangerous." The psychiatrist did not give the family the information that they needed to make a rational decision.
We have to remember this was 35 years ago, and 35 years ago people didn't talk about this openly. There were no radio or television programs for the most part about this kind of thing. People didn't talk about it, didn't know about it.
Well, it was a little bit better in Canada, and I think the stigma is a little bit less in Canada, but still it's almost like, you know, when your beloved parent or grandparent begins showing signs of dementia. You don't want to believe it. You want to make excuses. You want to say, "Oh, well, you know, they're just getting a little older," or he's having a flashback to the war.
Or all older people are forgetful about some things.
Right.
So it's not a big deal.
Exactly. But I think when the psychiatrist came and said, I want Bruce to start seeing me on a weekly basis," the family then was able to say, "Okay, we've done what we need to do. He's going to get the care that he needs. He's going to get the medication that he needs." When he took the medication, he was okay, but he, again, stopped taking his meds. the symptoms began to build and build until he didn't take his medication at all. The family didn't know that. They weren't counting the medication. They weren't watching him take it. He wasn't being given the injectable, the long-acting injectable, which was an option back then and would have helped significantly. I think that the family just didn't want to admit that their son was seriously mentally ill. They did the minimum that they could. And you know, the dad, for whatever reason, thought that he could, quote, talk Bruce through his difficulties.
Now, I don't know what the situation was with Adam Lanza or where he was in his psychosis or what doctors knew about him. I think he'd been examined, and doctors had said there was something wrong with him. But if you are diagnosed as somebody who is potentially dangerous to themselves or others, is there nothing mandatory that the state does for those people or to those people by institutionalizing them or putting them under the care of a mental health professional, mandatorily speaking?
Sure. And this is where, and I think just in general, the balance between individual civil liberties and the needs of an individual and a community are things that we weigh and deal with on a daily basis. But other than psychiatric hospitalization, which is one option, there are other services available. And I know here in Mecklenburg, we use outpatient commitment, which would be a less restrictive intervention, something where someone is required to see their psychiatrist, follow up with care, and maybe using once a month injectable medications. And as part of their being in a community, they need to follow that commitment.
Are schizophrenics who go undiagnosed or untreated going to become worse and worse and ultimately become people who are serious threats to themselves and the community? Or do some of them simply reach a plateau and that's where they stay?
Well, the level of risk from an individual with schizophrenia in terms of violent behavior is about the same as someone with an addiction, a substance abuse or drug addiction, which is much higher than the general population. But it's still the diagnosis of schizophrenia doesn't mean someone is going to become violent or aggressive or assaultive. Just by having that diagnosis doesn't mean you need to be hospitalized or have these sort of wraparound services, but certainly they're at risk and they need the support.
Bruce's attack on his family was horrific. We don't need to get into the details. It was horrific, and you are highly detailed about it in the book. And immediately after that, he knew that he had done something horrible. He knew that he had done something wrong. Do we understand what that phenomenon is all about? First of all, what triggered it? What was it about that moment in time that said, now's the time to do this? And then when it was done, why did he suddenly realize, oh my gosh, I've done something bad?
Well, I can tell you what quote, triggered it, and then the doctor can answer the second part of the question. But it was a cascade of disastrous coincidences. Bruce was, again, the family, just clueless. They put him on a bus to go up into the interior of British Columbia to start a millwright course. And on the bus, on the ride up...
I'm going to do it to you again. I'm going to make you stop.
This is a good one, though.
Okay, it's a cliffhanger. We'll bring it back to that story and get an answer to the other part of that question in just a couple of seconds. We have to take a break. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Beaver Productions, presenting James Taylor and his band at Greensboro Coliseum on Friday, July 31st. Tickets available now, Ticketmaster.com. More than 2,500 have lost their lives in a magnitude 7.8 earthquake that hit Nepal on Saturday. The latest from Kathmandu and new questions about preparing for and predicting seismic activity. The topic of the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. And we're coming right back.
Mm-hmm. So we're on the highway speeding southward out of Tehran.
From the deserts of Iran to the plains of North Dakota.
This is a classic Main Street. I'm standing on Dakota Avenue.
Every day, Morning Edition takes you to the news.
We went to this rally in the southern city of Kandahar for candidate Abdullah.
Take a journey with us. Start tomorrow with Morning Edition from NPR News.
Catch Morning Edition weekdays from 5 until 9 here on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about mass murderers, schizophrenics, people who are left untreated and go on to commit these horrible tragedies, and the cost to society and the holes in the system that allow this to happen all too frequently. Janice Holly Booth has written about one particular case in A Voice Out of Nowhere, Inside the Mind of a Mass Murderer. Dr. Stephen Strzelecki is also with us, administrator, lead psychologist with the Forensic Evaluations Unit in the Criminal Justice Services Department in Mecklenburg County. Now, I asked you what triggered this particular event, and just prior to the event, his parents put him on a bus to go to a camp, kind of a skills camp, a kind of an artsy camp.
No, it was more a technical college.
Okay.
For a Millwright course.
Millwright, that's right.
And Bruce was fairly psychotic at the time. Uh-huh. So they put him on a bus. Onto the bus walks this hippie girl, not big hips, but, you know.
It was the 80s.
Yes, it was the 80s.
She was a hippie.
She was a hippie. And she sat right down next to him and tapped him on the temple and said, "Have you heard about the star? There's a bug in the star." And that was it. Bruce was just completely infatuated with her story. "Tell me about the star. Tell me about the star." And she began telling him things like, "I've died four times, and I never bled once because I kept coming back. The world needed me for something." So he rides the bus with this woman who's planting all kinds of comforting stories in his mind. He finally gets to the college. He goes to sign in, puts out his hand. They put a key in his hand for his dorm, but he believes this is the key to saving the world. He spends the night. He catches a plane home. And in his mind, he had figured it out. Mary had told him there was a bug in the star. She had told him that you don't bleed when you die because if you're needed for a purpose, you'll come back. Bruce believed that by killing his family, they would all ascend to heaven and hold the heavens together and avoid Armageddon. So when he committed these murders, believe it or not, he was doing it out of love. He felt like he was preserving his family forever in the heavens and that he was saving the world. Mm. Now, later, after he was arrested and he came down from his psychosis, yes, he began to cry and ask, "Why did I do it? Why did I do it?" And I will turn it over to the doctor.
He knew almost immediately that he'd done something bad.
He did, and I think
when they're in the midst of committing these things, do all systems shut down except that one system, and then suddenly when it's over, the adrenaline rush goes away, and their eyes are open? What's going on there?
And that's part of it. So the acute psychosis isn't necessarily 24 hours a day. It is in periods, and in Bruce's case, as the command hallucinations were becoming more intense, he was losing increasing touch with reality, acting in this violent, aggressive way, and then would have a pause, have some rational thought, but then the command hallucinations are reoccurring, pushing him forward to commit more violent acts. So it wasn't as if it was consistent. It was an up and down of that experience. And then afterwards, getting feedback from the environment, from the officers interviewing him, had, again, an intelligent young man who knew that what he did was wrong.
Mental institutions were never great places. Some of them were horrible places, but we felt in the 80s and in some cases before that, that people should be released from those horrible places and they'd be better off in the real world. And the result of that, in part, has been that we now have people who aren't competent, who do commit crimes, who do things that are dangerous to themselves and others, who then end up in the criminal justice system. We put them away in prisons. You said in the break that we incarcerate more people who are mentally ill than we treat in this country. And the cost, if I'm right about this, is about $100 billion a year.
That doesn't surprise me. The cost doesn't surprise me. What surprises me is that we live in a country that's so good at figuring things out, that's so good at creating new and wonderful toys for us to spend a ton of money on, and we can't fix this problem. I don't get it. But I do believe, and I'm sorry to have this negative attitude, that it's a population we don't care about. I don't think that we would accept this kind of malaise in pediatrics or oncology or cardiology. We wouldn't stand for it.
These are people's children. These are people's husbands and wives and brothers and sisters. These are individuals. Are there just not enough people who are affected directly by this who care? How about the victims' families in Sandy Hook, in Colorado, at Columbine, et cetera?
Well, just talking about parents of children who are mentally ill, I mean, you have people with tremendous influence. You have Patrick Kennedy, for example, right, who is an outspoken advocate for the mentally ill. You have Senator Cree Deeds, who tried to have his son committed.
And he's the senator from...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Tried to have his son committed. They couldn't find him a psychiatric bed, and so...
Virginia.
Yes, they had to release him under the law. The next day, the son attacked his father with a knife and then shot himself dead. So when you have people with influence and voice and credibility out there on the soapbox making noise and still nothing has happened, you have to wonder, what is wrong with us?
And since we've been taking this approach, the number of mass murders such as this have increased dramatically.
Yes.
I know you have a chart in your book. I couldn't find it, but it's increased dramatically in the last, 75 years, 70 years, 30 years, 40 years?
100.
100 years.
100 years.
So clearly we've been keeping track of this. So, Doctor, why don't we take this more seriously? Why isn't this?
Again, I think this certainly is a vulnerable population, individuals with serious mental illness, recurrent difficulties. They certainly can cycle in and out of the legal system, the justice system, where they are committing maybe minor crimes, mm-hmm, and then are incarcerated for a brief period of time, released, and cycle in and out, not getting medication as they require. But in terms of in Mecklenburg County, we are working to try to put together a network, and there is certainly services available within the community, within the legal system, to try to meet the needs of these individuals.
You are the lead psychologist in the forensic evaluations unit. What does that mean? What is the forensic evaluations unit, and how does a psychologist play into that?
Sure. And it's forensic not in terms of going to crime scenes and taking blood samples or things like that. What we do is we conduct evaluations that are court-ordered to help the court answer a psycho-legal question. So, for example, capacity to proceed to trial. Mm-hmm. And in Mecklenburg and in North Carolina, there's sort of a hybrid system where there are local evaluators, and then there's a centralized location at a Central Regional Hospital in Butner that also conducts evaluations. And so the court will order an evaluation to evaluate a defendant to see if they have capacity or competent to proceed to trial. And in our justice system, out of fairness, someone has to be mentally present to be tried and prosecuted.
You may have hard figures on this, but if you don't, just anecdotally, how many people who go through our system in Mecklenburg County who have committed crimes or allegedly have committed crimes have done so because they are in some way mentally incapacitated or challenged?
Sure. I don't have the hard figures, but of our referrals, probably a third or so of the people who we evaluate do not have capacity to proceed to trial because they, at the time they're being evaluated, they cannot stand for trial because they don't understand what the charge is, or they cannot work with their attorney in a reasonable manner.
Well, according to the Mental Health Association of the Central Carolinas, mental illnesses or psychiatric illnesses impact about 1 in every 4 adults in the country every year. That's 25% of people. And 2/3 of those people will not receive treatment or services. If you think that's true, and I don't know that you do, but if you do, why haven't we been more aggressive in establishing a system to help these people?
Well, we have certainly community resources and services that are available. This past year, as you may know, the county mental health system went from being operated by MechLink, part of the county, to Cardinal Innovations, which is the managed care organization that oversees the county services. There are a lot of resources available. There are outreach services that are available, but there's still a large voluntary component to seeking mental health services. And whether it is individual or family stigma about seeking services, there's still a hesitation.
I'm curious about this 25%, because to me that's an enormous number of people. A quarter of the adults walking around on the street today are suffering a mental illness.
Sure, and that ranges anxiety and depression up through the more serious things like bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. So it's a whole range of difficulties, some of which are being treated and managed, but it's just part of their makeup.
Do 25% of us at any given time suffer from the common cold? Do 25% of us at any given time have a stomach virus?
Well, I think when you're saying suffer from a mental illness, you're talking about a whole range of different kinds of disorders. So from someone who has experienced post-traumatic stress disorder from experiencing a horrific experience is very different than someone who has a genetic component and then develops schizophrenia. So it's a broader concept of terms of illnesses, mental illness versus gastrointestinal or upper respiratory.
And yet we would seek a doctor's help.
Exactly.
If we got a cold or a virus or something, we would go to the doctor. We want an antibiotic or something. Why don't we go to the doctor when we're depressed or we have anxiety attacks or we are hearing voices? Why don't we go?
And that is a great question. And that's the first place you can go. You can go to your family physician and say, I'm having this struggle. I'm having problems with sleeping, and I'm having these I'm sweating, I'm nervous.
But is it because there's a stigma attached to it? Is it because we're embarrassed to talk about these things with our own doctor?
Maybe that's part of the American psyche of, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps and handle it yourself versus understanding what mental illness is.
Is it different in other countries?
Maybe a little bit different in European countries, but certainly.
Why? Because they have better health care, a better health care system, and better access to because of universal insurance? Why?
Some of that, and it's more integrated. And that's a model that we're moving towards in the United States and certainly in North Carolina and Mecklenburg of having mental health services available with primary care physicians so that you don't have to go to a specialist. It's part of your just total health care.
Because you wrote about Dr. Eugene Maloney, Janice, who is a forensic psychiatrist in North Carolina, as saying that many times, those who make the decision to release a formerly mentally ill offender don't have the medical training necessary to understand their decisions on the mentally ill. And he also cites the deterioration in mental health care. I don't know how long ago this quote was, but the corruption of the drug companies and misguided public perception that mental illness is a reaction to something in the environment. What does he mean by the corruption of the drug companies?
Well, for that quote, he was talking about the availability of a perfectly good, long-lasting injectable drug that costs $5. Mm-hmm. And suddenly a new better, quote, better drug had emerged, and I believe the cost was $1,200 per shot. So who benefits from that? Certainly not the patient. And the other thing that Dr. Maloney was frustrated about was people making the laws around mental illness lacked the medical training to really understand the impact of these laws on people with mental illness.
At the time that Bruce Blackman, the man you write about in your book, killed the six members of his family, there were laws in Canada requiring leniency of sentencing for those who are not criminally responsible on account of mental disorder. We would call that, I can't think of the term now.
Not guilty by reason of insanity. Thank
you. Not guilty by reason of insanity. Today, he's 55 years old. He's out.
Yes.
He's out and he's living anonymously somewhere in Canada. Do people keep tabs on him? Do they keep track of him? Or has he served his time and he's out?
Well, what happened in Canada, and I believe it happens here as well, is if you've been found not criminally responsible due to mental disorder, you will go away to a secure forensic facility for a period of time, and you will be treated. And at some point, when you are no longer a danger to yourself or others, you have the right to go before a review board and ask petition for your release. Now, if the doctor says Bruce has been a model patient, he's completely free of psychosis, he's been compliant, then he'll be given freedoms, limited freedoms. He'll get grounds passes, supervised ground passes, supervised day passes. And then unsupervised day passes where he has to come back to the institution to be medicated, et cetera. But the final is a complete release. And once that happens, there's no system in place to support him.
This is not unlike John Hinckley, who now spends days at home in his mother's home. He's the guy who shot President Reagan and James Brady, who lived for the rest of his life and probably died prematurely because of the injuries he received at that attack at the Washington Hilton years ago. And he wants to be released.
He does.
And is that likely to happen in the United States?
Well, he's, my understanding, about half of the month he is out of the facility where he lives. So he's more than halfway there to living in a community with his mother in a gated community.
So the key here is that these people can be, in many cases, not all, can be treated, can become relatively normal as long as they're on their medication. But if you're released and you're not under supervision, how do you know they're staying on those medications?
And that's the key. That's having a case manager, care support, a wraparound team, or an outpatient commitment. Those are the kinds of services that can ensure and follow up an individual to make sure they're compliant with medication and the services they require.
In this country, is your diagnosis and treatment dependent on whether your monetary status, whether or not you have can afford the treatment, whether or not you have insurance? Are there lots of people falling through the cracks because they don't have insurance?
They are less likely to receive services, but there are services for indigent individuals. Mm-hmm. So if you have a major mental illness, if you require it, you can call, Cardinal Innovations has access number to call them 24 hours a day. Monarch Services in Mecklenburg County has a walk-in clinic that is available for indigent population. We have grant programs who are actually actively seeking individuals in the community who need services.
And,
so
we have,
available.
And we have to leave it there. Dr. Stephen Strzelecki, Administrator, Lead Psychologist for the Forensic Evaluations Unit in the Criminal Justice Services Department of Mecklenburg County. Janice Holly Booth's book is called A Voice Out of Nowhere. Thank you for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. Our producers are Aaron Kiever and Tim Ross. Our associate producer is Alexia Girodi, and the engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about archives, upcoming shows, and podcasts, or to continue the conversation online, visit our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks.
And support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Carolina Neurosurgery and Spine Associates, celebrating 75 years of spine and brain care. Carolina Neurosurgery and Spine Associates has a team of 45 specialists and 9 area offices. Details at